The following is a conversation with Leire Asensio Villoria and David Ma on decoding and upgrading design systems, reverse engineering the creative process, knowledge dissemination, and much more. Hey, it's Nono, and this is the Getting Simple podcast. Let's start with who is Erwin Hauer.
Erwin Hauer is, or rather I should say, Erwin Hauer was an artist born in Austria and someone that migrated to the US and taught at Yale University for a long time and produced an amazing range of art pieces. He was a sculptor and he started his artwork career in Austria, as I said before, as a student. And some of those pieces that he actually created while being a student became major pieces, major artwork in his repertoire, basically, that we were very fascinated with and continue to be fascinated with.
The main body of work that, the book tries to engage with or talks about a lot of the topics of the book through, a lot of that was actually done while he was in Vienna, so prior to his migration to the United States. But my understanding is that he went to the United States on a scholarship, began at RISD, and then he was, he kind of joined Joseph Albers's faculty at Yale, first as a student and then subsequently as a teacher. And that, you know, as many people know, that that group ended up producing a lot of very kind of well-known artists in their own right, Sheila Hicks and other people like that. And he was part of that group. And, in many ways, the Erwin Hauer, that was him. But to us personally, he was also a kind of a fascinating figure whose work, was kind of enigmatic and for us, you know, warranted a bit more of an exploration somehow.
Yeah. How would you define an associative model?
So associative model in its most technical terms are models that are able to kind of have, let's say, variations or variables that actually allow it to kind of differentiate according to different associations. So they could be associations to performance or associations to, it could even simply just be geometric associations across the model. But a lot of discussions around the associative model is really this idea that it's a model that puts in a hierarchy, aggregates a series of, let's say, geometries. And as a consequence, it can be then linked to other concerns that allow it to vary and adapt to what those concerns are. So that's at the most technical level. I think the way that we've adopted it in the book is that it also operates as a kind of way to think through a lot of the topics that are engaged in the book. So it also became a conceptual tool in the sense that we dissociated a number of practices and concerns that were done in the book. And then as a consequence of that, those also formed their own association. So it almost builds a kind of small cosmology within the kind of the research, if you like. So I think in one level, the associative model is a very directly the model that you see in the book that takes the redescription of a lot of the work. And then he finds a generative role for it at a kind of direct material level. And in another sense, that bridge between those two things already becomes a conceptual tool for us to think about the larger issues in the book.
Okay, so as I understand it, this is, we can maybe refer it as a parametric model, something that you parameterize. Sure. It's like a modular design or something that, like a generative design that generates some artifacts on the computer. You've talked on the book also about the translation to its material form, like constructing or like fabricating something that we can discuss later. And one thing that I thought while I was looking at the book and at Hauer's work is we do it today with things like Grasshopper or other programming tools, but how did he do it back like maybe 70 years ago or like whenever he started? How did he, maybe to rephrase the question, like how did he construct these models or how he ideated these minimal surfaces?
So actually, no. Before I address this question directly, I should say that I was precisely going to add to David's definition of the associative model before that something that for us was interesting is that in a way we've been dealing with associative models prior to the existence of the software that allows for parametric modeling, et cetera, with certain ease. So some of the fascination with precedents that we had been researching over the years, such as John Utzon, if we look at the Arup beam, is that create through this associative model, creates such a clear synthesis of the relationships across many different parameters that deal with various matters of concerns and concepts, et cetera, through the synthesis of that model. You know, it somehow becomes very clear how these relationships are about and the variation in the production of a range of outcomes, basically, from, you know, the insertion of various values. And that was obviously done way before, you know, softwares like Grasshopper, et cetera, appear. So just with that in mind, I will say that the case of Howard is a very particular one because he was an artist, as I mentioned, and his medium was not even that of representation by a drawing, but a sculpting. So some of the early, if you wish, sketches that we got to see by visiting his studio and having conversations with him were even through wires, you know, bending wires three-dimensionally and really creating like a sculpture that's, you know, with building these models directly there. So his visual capabilities were incredible, I will say, to create pieces that he was generating. So he's quite different from other precedents that we've been looking at, in the sense that there was not such a clear material as to how he arrived to the objects that he arrived to.
Yeah, I guess that talks a lot about the limitations. I was going to ask about what are the limitations of the digital tools that we use today and how did they do it before, as I said earlier. I think, for example, when you are on the computer, when you jump straight away into modeling on the computer, there are many limitations, also constraints that might make you more creative in different ways. How do you think a sculptor, and I think it's not a coincidence, right, that he was a sculptor and he ended up doing these things, because I think drawing in this case would have been a harder tool to come up with those sculptures. Or those shapes, right? He was directly manipulating material, but on paper, we're just trying to mimic a 3D perspective or 2D drawings. And and on the computer, we're always jumping from 2D to 3D, but it's also hard to encode the rules that he developed in different models.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, it's communicated where a lot of it was quite intuitive, but it's quite clear. If you look at the way that they also represent, so him and his partner, Enrique Rosado, is a partner that joined him later in life. And that was actually a moment where they actually reverse engineered a lot of his early work so that it can be digitized. There was a moment towards, you know, the later part of his career where together with Enrique, there was an ambition to kind of reverse engineer that earlier work into models that could actually be done with digital fabrication, right? But the way that they talked about it, you could see that there's a clear understanding, or there was at least a sensibility attached to mathematical concepts. So they talked about the suture curve, which, I mean, you know, one sense it's mathematical, but on the other sense, you could also tie it to very tangible things. So they also talk about it in relationship to baseballs, right? So it's the thing that allows you to, you know, make baseballs in a certain way, and same with tennis balls. So, you know, there's that aspect of it as well. So I think somehow what we found interesting was this conversation between a kind of very tangible material way of operating and the discoveries that come with that. But there's also a way that you, I don't know if the word is rationalize it, but you tame it, or you find a kind of a way to kind of generalize it through mathematical, you know, a conversation with mathematics, right? Which is what I think either it was reverse engineered or it was something that was happening in parallel when he was doing that work.
I'm going to take a moment just to show here the book so we can tell everyone what we're talking about today. I kind of didn't introduce it before. The book that Larry and David have published recently is called Systems Upgrade, refabricating tectonic prototypes. So a lot of the work in that book is inspired by the model or constructivism, the different models that Irving Hauer created during his lifetime. He passed away a couple of years ago, sadly. And they talk a lot about studying existing. You can talk about that better, probably. But as I understand it, studying existing designs and trying to reverse engineer them, to decode their rules and maybe convert them into a digital form so they can be modified, they can be adapted, and we can iterate faster, right? That's something that probably, thinking back to how they did it 70 years ago or like a longer time ago, how they iterated, it was probably more mathematical, more manual work, more labor intensive things, but also probably giving people more time to think about what they were doing, right? Today we do things really fast and sometimes we don't even process that information. So can you comment on, so people can understand, why would you reverse engineer a historical design?
One of the things that we found with a lot of discussions at the time around the integration of digital processes and tools in architecture was that there was a kind of, understandably, it was a moment where there was an explosion of capacity to kind of explore, you know, directly with a lot of the tools that were, you know, and particularly within the academic institutions. You know, up to that point, there wasn't really a lot of institutions that had a lot of robots that you could actually do research with. But it was a moment then where it started to happen, it started to become accessible. So a lot of the discussion kind of really centered around, you know, what's possible through the technique. What is the kind of, what's the kind of operative technical capacities that are afforded by digital design and fabrication? And somehow, you know, I don't think it was through neglect, but it was, you know, there was a focus centered on something else. So there was a little bit of a discussion about how does this connect or how does this associate itself with, you know, things that happened in the past with design culture in the past hadn't been clearly articulated. So I think through Leder's course, there was an acknowledgement that there was a period, somehow there was a subsection of design creative practice during the modern period, which had some relevance. You know, there's a lot of these people like Fisak, Fuller, and all of these designers who were interested in developing not one-off architectural pieces, but they were much more interested in developing systems, you know, constructive systems that could actually be, I guess, making full use of the kind of industrial modern kind of paradigm, right? It's really about kind of these systems. So there was some recognition that there could be something learned from that as a starting point. So it kind of engaged with history in that sense. And, you know, one of the things is that you could simply study the precedents, but we also were quite interested in using the tools that are afforded to us, you know, like the associative model as a tool to study history. So it was a way to basically decode the existing artifacts, reverse engineer them. In one sense, you get an approximation of, you know, the forms and the material forms that were produced. But on the other sense, perhaps to some extent, maybe you're also tapping into the ways in which the designers also found a way to kind of develop the forms themselves, right? So you're kind of, it's, you know, you're not just doing a kind of archaeological history of the design artifact. You're also doing to some extent a history or study of designing somehow, like the design process to describe the artifacts. That became a way of studying historical artifacts for us. And it also became the same medium or mechanism that potentially gave us opportunities to make it a generative tool, right? Because you have, in some sense, embedded inside the model, a kind of collapsing of the geometric code and the processes that are there to kind of create it somehow.
Just to emphasize on something that even prior to the course David is referring to in refabricating tectonic prototypes, which I led at Harvard for a number of years, even before that, in our own research, other studios, et cetera, that David and I had taught in different places like Cornell or DAA, we were always very aware of the fact that a lot of the current, and by current I mean at the time, digital design practices that were emerging, et cetera, seemed to want to position themselves as something completely cut off from any other historical model. And the more we look into it, the more we found links to this sort of detours to the mainstream that David was talking about through figures like Buckminster Fuller, Miguel Pisac, and Aldo Dieste, and many others that we looked into, that John Utzon, that we thought they had a lot of linkages to what we were seeing emerging at the time. And rather than adopting the position of completely cutting or removing ourselves from those historical precedents, we started to research into them and identified that a lot of the constructive systems and prototypes that they, and tectonic prototypes that they had devised, they were still, again, not only they had these strong ties, but they had a lot of potential to be recontextualized under contemporary lenses of not just fabrication, but also other urgencies, you know, whether environmental or other of other kinds, that we could actually tap into those basically and create these linkages. And that happened not only today, we are here to discuss systems upgrade, but has not only happened in at the scale of the tectonic level that we've been investigating, but also in our studies on urban prototypes and, you know, other scales that we're looking at. So it's something that somehow is present at many levels in the work that we've been doing. But yeah, I hope that helps as well.
I mean, there's one more thing about that question. It's one of the things is that a lot of those precedents that we were looking at, like people like Buckminster Fuller, and also by association, you could be talking about Viktor Papanek and all of these other people. There was already an environmental and ecological consciousness that was driving a lot of the work, right? And I think a lot of that is also relevant today, can be recontextualized, you know, within the current discussions about, you know, how we reconsider the way that we do buildings or that we approach, the construction with an ecological environmental mindset, but, you know, obviously upgrading it to, you know, what we know now. But, you know, definitely Fuller and Papanek were very much driven by the concerns which are even more present today somehow, right? So I think those are also for us relevant reasons why you would want to go back and revisit those legacies, if you like.
And how would you break down the steps of a digital archaeological investigation? So I understand digital archaeological investigation is similar to reverse engineering, right? But I like that term, how you called it, because it brings methods from design research and from methods that we've seen in studying precedents from archaeology. That is something that probably is more common to other people. So if you can maybe break this down, the steps on when you study something, how you encode it into the computer, how you maybe fabricate it.
It's a little bit more traditional in the sense that now we have a lot of tools, digital tools that probably give you like literally what the artifact is. So you could do 3D scanning or LiDAR scanning, all of these things give you a very clear capture of the digital artifact itself. But, you know, in some senses, it could be more akin to when an archaeologist is faced with artifacts that are broken. And then they got to figure out how were these put back together in some senses? What is the way in which they can be remodeled? So I think, we found that as a kind of very fruitful exercise, because it doesn't just tap into a record or an archiving, a digital archiving or translating of the kind of material into a digital format of what exists in a literal sense. There was also a part of that was about how you go about doing translating that into a series of protocols, like a series of steps. So again, you know, it revisits this idea of not just tapping into the object, but also tapping into the process that goes behind describing it. So a couple of examples that we put in the book that we found very interesting at the architectural scale, one of them was the Dresden Cathedral project, which, you know, they actually went through the whole effort of taking a lot of the rubble that was left over from the bombing in World War II, trying to find a way in which they could actually re-embed that actual physical material into the rebuilding of the Dresden Cathedral, right? So, you know, that required a lot of, let's say, reverse engineering in the process. And that's one example. The other example is the Sagrada Familia, right? So apparently, you know, a lot of the early researchers looking at how they could extend the design was to study whatever was left of the artifacts from Gaudi's archives, because a lot of it was actually destroyed at some point. And then they just reverse engineer it, study it geometrically. And through that study geometrically, they were able to kind of tap in and find out, I guess, the sensibility and the processes that he would have used. And they could actually extend that knowledge. Once they've got that knowledge, they could extend it into doing the design from that knowledge drawn from the artifacts that existed somehow.
Yeah. No, I think that that's great. So in upper, so departing from that, I think the first thing that David mentioned, I mean, you were completely right. I mean, if you want a very, very precise description of the object or the tectonic prototype of a study, you could 3D scan it. And you, there you have the object. But we're more interested in a way to precisely decoded that object or finding ways in which we could then actually manipulate and generate, turn it into a source of new outcomes, basically, as well. So we always have this disclaimer that it might not be as, the word wouldn't be faithful, but as precise in terms of replica, because we are not after the idea of replicating the found object, but rather finding what are the systems underneath, uncovering the systems underneath those tectonic prototypes that will allow us to keep working on them, basically. So in that sense, I mean, I don't know if this is the sort of answer you're after, but there is an initial very heavily back and forth. You mentioned before the issue of the medium. So if we talk very specifically about how we went about this, it didn't magically just turn into, you know, the associative model that is working perfectly fine, but it went through encoding specific parts of that object. For example, if you were mentioning about hardware, for us, understanding that continua, that invisible line of the continua surface, or the kind of medium of that surface that it starts to suggest the generation of the overall part-to-whole relationship, was very important. So David mentioned about the suture curve. I mean, as you know, hardware, there's not a lot of bibliography on hardware, and needless to say, there is not much information about how he generated the pieces. So this is our interpretation of his pieces at the level of the pre-description phase that we are going through, no? The digital archaeology we were mentioning. So there was somewhere that we read through Howard's writing something about the suture curve, you know, that curve that allows you to create a sphere, to fabricate a sphere in the most kind of closest spherical surface. And that's why you need the suture curve as opposed to having the equator cut, basically, or the great circle, because it allows you to stitch the material that you're using, leather or whatever it is, in a much more precise manner that resembles the sphere. So that started to trigger a whole set of, you know, studies as to how do we get to that suture curve. Yeah. So then we started to investigate different intersections of spheres within upper surfaces that generate this suture curve, basically. And of course, then you start getting a whole range of other studies, how you move from that suture curve into generating the surfaces that go around, for example, the first of his designs, that even when visiting him in one of his books, it is described as two handles, but even when visiting the studio, became very clear he never generated it that way. He described it that way later on, but it was extremely helpful for us to read it in that manner, you know, to start dissecting our suture curve in certain ways that we could get to the basic module that then could be aggregated in series in certain manners and generate the overall surface. Then we talk about thickness and the way in which Howard starts to give thickness to those surfaces is very particular, because you don't find a single, let's say, line within it. It's all this very smooth surface, because he's, at the end of the day, a sculptor. So perhaps we, from the architecture perspective, were less interested in that particular smoothness of the object as such. So there are certain things that we were happy to let go slightly. But what I'm trying to say is that as you move forward in this reverse engineering, you identify more things that become challenges and you start to kind of work through it. So in a way, I would say bottom line, very iterative manner, moving across mediums, you know, because definitely there were from hand sketches to translating to just basic descriptive geometry on the computer before moving into any other, perhaps more sophisticated parametric software, and a lot of model making as well, you know, along the way, like meaning physical model making, just for that phase. I mean, this, of course, repeats itself in many of the other phases of the design process that we went through after the redescription phase, basically. But yeah.
One of the very important parts of Leda's course, when they were doing the redescribing or coming to terms with the precedent, was they also fabricated like the original pieces as they were before doing any design variation. So there's a kind of geometric coming to terms with it through the associative model geometrically, but there's also that conversation or dialogue with this kind of fabrication process, like the materialization too. So that was quite I think that was a very important part in the course too, I think, that conversation somehow.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, did you end up sharing with Irving the encoded models, right? Like, what did he say? I would be really surprised that people encode all the logic behind.
One thing we have to say is that he did come to visit the course a couple of times, and that was at a very early stage. I think, you know, it was quite advanced in the encoding, but later has spent quite a long time, and then ever since the end of the course, spent more time trying to decode it. So that's so he saw it in a kind of mid stage, I think, in some ways. So, you know,
I think relatively, anyway. Probably early to mid, because this course ran for about 6 years. And I think he came on the second and third year. Basically, we went to him once and he came to us another time. So when he was at the GSD, we show some of the material that was being produced in the course. And yeah, I mean, let's say that, again, there is no claim that we have decoded exactly what he did with the exact steps that he did. No, we are trying to approach it from an architectural perspective and seeing how we can actually, in a way, extend some of these potentials within our field, basically. So in no way the attempt is to create replicas of our work.
I mean, just also to give you a sense, there was one design called Design One, which is one of his earliest iterations. And we did three or four variations of how you reverse engineer the same design. Because, you know, if you wanted to do a very kind of try to approximate as close as you possibly can with the associative model tools to the actual physical artifact, you know, you could generate a certain kind of model. And we found, you know, when we tried to use that as a generative model, because it was so, I don't know if the word is perfect, but let's say it was getting so close to all of the kind of surface conditions that he had, you know, brought in through the sanding and all of those sorts of things that he was doing, it became quite hard to generate anything novel as far as the variations go. It was quite tight somehow, which is probably what it wanted to be, because, you know, that approach was probably to reach some degree of, let's say, perfection somehow, right? So it was hard to make something valuable, too much different from that. But if you know, there was other models that use more schematic, where we actually reduced some of the detail in it. And that, you know, that was much easier to kind of generate quite a wide range or wide spectrum of other possible variations from that initial set of associations. So, you know, that's, we were also investigating it, trying to kind of approximate the thing as much as close as possible, but also looking for, you know, how you would actually do that coding of the artifacts so that you could also be a generative tool. So there were sometimes moments where you'd want to remove some of the detail or remove being so close to the original so that it actually has, you know, other value, other potentials as a generative tool somehow. Right.
I guess like the parametric model was getting too many parameters, right? Like it's at the end of the day, it's like restraining it too much.
Yeah.
Yes. And focusing perhaps too much on aspects that were of interest to power, but that perhaps we didn't find that in the range of options or alternatives, that's not the word actually, let's say the new generated outcomes, perhaps those were not key for us in as I was mentioning before, or David was mentioning, the precise curvature around each of the surfaces that, you know, we could do away without it in the process of generating something else, even if it's something that you can come back to it later. But yeah.
Okay. So I see in the book, you referred a bit to hackers, right? Like cracking code for the illegal duplication proprietary software, right? And then talk a bit about knowledge dissemination, open source, and these type of things, and patents as well. I'll read here briefly the open source initiative definition of open source that you've put on the book. The basic idea behind open source is very simple. When programmers can read, redistribute, and modify the source code for a piece of software, the software evolves. People improve it, people adapt it, people fix bugs. So I'm a really big advocate of open source. And, you know, there is this duality between unique authorship and patents giving designers profit, and on the other side, open source code, right? Both can, in some ways, as you mentioned on the book, help disseminate knowledge that exists by encoding the rules or the ways in which you can replicate things. But I wanted to hear from you, for example, I think Irving Howard had patents on some of his designs. And I understand that for some people, it's a means of maybe making some money or like protecting the design so they can continue innovating in that way with some sort of authorship. So yeah, I just want to hear your take on this in general. We can dig more deeply later.
You know, as you said before, both patents and open source are meant to be models of disseminating innovation, if you like. A lot of patents, once they expire, they go into the public domain. But I guess there's differences in the sense that sometimes they have other things associated with them. But you know, the thing we were proposing, so you've got to understand that this was also coming from a creative practice angle, but it was also coming primarily from a research angle where we were looking, speculating on thinking about the connections between, you know, what was more associated with that period, the earlier period of the precedents that we're talking about, where there was a very strong idea of the authorship in that sense. And there was the author as a person who was, you know, kind of did the authentic artifact. And what we wanted to do was, through the research project, we wanted to kind of say that there is, you know, that's one model. But if we want to recontextualize that history, you know, that approach, that, you know, that reframed through the lens of, you know, contemporary practices, open source challenges that a little bit. I mean, the aim is the same in the sense that, you know, you want to disseminate an invention in a certain way, but then, you know, that becomes a totally different model where you're talking about multiple authors and you know, authorship becomes a big question mark. And then it's a constantly evolving thing. It's a more of a system that's constantly open to evolution, right? So we also wanted to use it from a kind of academic point of view to also show the distinction between probably the idea of the author and the authentic, perfect, or, you know, optimized artifact versus this idea of the possibility of it becoming more about a unfinished. It's a kind of always unfinished system that could actually spawn many, many different artifacts, if you like, and also be engaging many, many different authors. So we wanted to kind of make that distinction to say that, you know, because of these new technologies and these new platforms and these, you know, the networks, that challenges the previous understanding of systems and, you know, in architecture. And that this is the other, you know, this is another model that's, you know, that's already being picked up on in a lot of circles of the industry and the discipline as well. But we wanted to make that distinction to say, okay, so if we're going to reframe that, this older model, we also have to kind of consider it within this new light as well as something different. So also, what you're aiming for is going to be different. We're not going to be aiming for the perfect sculptural model. We are going to be aiming for a model that can generate as many possible variations as you can to find, you know, different things somehow and allow for different authors to be involved somehow.
And I think it's also worth noting that, again, we have studied a number of other precedents that fall more within the disciplines of architecture, engineering. This systems upgrade has a special focus on departing from Howard's work and him coming from the discipline of art, basically, which probably generally there is more dependency to fall within that, trying to find that perfect outcome that, David, you were mentioning, whereas already in the nature of the associative model that we are working with and advocating in a way in the book, there is this idea of the unfinished system that is in constant evolution and you know, depending on context, the scenarios, needs, etc., you will generate different outcomes from that base associative model. So in a way, it was interesting to us to see how that can be taken by other people and continue. And I think that we had a mini simulation through this course as well, because that base prescription was given to the students, not just in a few of the pieces from Howard, but also, as we mentioned, from many other modernist figures. And it was extremely interesting what they could generate and where they could take those base models through the development of their own projects within the course, you know. So it was kind of interesting to see the mini simulation of how fertile these base associative models can be, basically, within our, at least I will say, within our field, no, of architecture.
And how do you think, or how would you say, visual programming helps or constrains, right? Because sometimes, well, I'll let you answer, but like, do you think it's better for students to do this in a visual programming environment, or would it be better doing it just in plain programming?
Yeah, you're talking about Grasshopper, right?
Yeah, Grasshopper, Dynamo, any of these visual programming environments.
It just makes it accessible, right? So we were talking about a moment in architectural design education where, you know, it was definitely prevalent and a lot of people were looking at it, but it was a moment where you were, you know, you were starting to teach design students some degree of programming and parametrics at a mass scale, right? Like, you know, everybody was kind of engaging with it. So it just makes it accessible in some sense. I mean, of course, now where we teach now in the Melbourne School of Design, every single bachelor student in their second year learns the Grasshopper now, right? So it's a different environment. But back then, it was something that was being introduced. And I think that accessibility is quite important in terms of getting as much people involved in the process. Like if we're talking about this model of multiple authors and open source and all of these sorts of logics, it's just good to get a larger community capable of being engaged and accessing it somehow.
I was going to just come back to the fact that when we started this research, software like Grasshopper didn't exist. I think we had the digital project, which was much harder to get into, especially for students with no previous experience. So at the very start of all this, we didn't really have the parametric software. We were showing it through actually how you draw these relationships and how do you, you know, are able to, through descriptive geometry, generate pretty precise, I will say, geometric associations and the descriptions. Then luckily, we, I think, as David said, made it easier for students to dive in when we got some softwares like Grasshopper, which was extremely fertile as well, and it is still to this date. But in the context of the course, I will say that we used to go to the core of teaching the geometric, descriptive geometry behind all this, how it works, and translating that to the environment of Grasshopper. Yes, that's, it was very helpful. Some students that were far more advanced in their digital skills, etc., could move into other forms of programming that move beyond Grasshopper, and that's great. But some other students had much more kind of had no previous background, and we had to start from from the start, I will say, like, you know, even starting drawing it in 2D and showing them how to translate to 3D and eventually Grasshopper. But really very important about understanding clearly, you're looking at geodesic spheres. Okay, how how you start everything from the icosahedron, how do you start creating different frequencies of that geodesic sphere, you know, and understanding the base of it, and then how sophisticated they could translate it into Grasshopper or not was a different Every year that the course went through the six years, I will say the last years, I mean, most of the students were very equipped with the skills to do it. The early years, I mean, they were, I think, the beginning of Grasshopper, really.
But I would say that beyond the actual tools that are used to kind of engage with it, I think at least for us, our understanding is that the code that we're dealing with in this instance is primarily the geometries. I mean, for us as architects and designers, the you know, we refer to the code in the reverse engineering not as the you know, not the model per se, but it's more of the association across the geometries, which is the code for us somehow. Right? How do you construct that composite geometry is the code. Yeah. And it's a language by which, you know, for centuries, you know, as designers we've been working with, but it's the one that still sustains itself in many ways. I mean, there can be other kind of procedural aspects that can be benefited from using, you know, explicitly coding, if you like. But for us, we thought that we also need to you know, evaluate the fact that the associations across geometries is our way of also, you know, developing a kind of codification of material and form as well. And it's the way that we can, you know, get good at using that, exploiting that as the means to describe and also generate somehow. Right?
I also want to bring another topic that you touch on the book that I really liked, that is, you know, when you go from mass production to standardization, right? Like when you allow these adaptable or customizable models to give a more granular output, right? Like something that is not always the, as you said before, bulk replication, that you can let each individual or maybe each company customize it before production. And, you know, this is what you mentioned with Chris Anderson, the long tail of niches and selling less of more. Right? I really like that, less of more. Can you comment a bit on that and where you think that is taking us? I have a quote here from the book that says, "The other effect of wider participation is that niche may become the norm."
I think niche becomes the norm. I think that's a direct, that's probably something picked up from Chris Anderson, right, himself. Again, we also have to kind of put the caveat that a lot of this was, I think it has a strong resonance with very direct practice and professional application, but we are also seeing it through the lens of, you know, as researchers and through academics, try to contextualize, again, make those bridges between these different ways of working. So the modern industrial paradigm to this model, and we're not literally saying that you have to do this, but this is, we're saying these are the opportunities or these are the different kinds of paradigms that are there, and this is, you know, we need to kind of consider them in that sense. You know, it's certainly as a consequence of that, the industrial production, because it is about the mass manufacturing, there is a tendency to have to kind of perfect, you know, what you're producing is a product which is perfect, right, in principle, or let's say optimize, and you can just do millions of them, if you like, or lots, you know, large batches of them. You know, if we're moving to an associative model, multi-authored, open source, you know, a distributed ecology of manufacturers, if we're kind of going to tap into the fourth industrial revolution kind of ideas, then, you know, you have the capacity not to have to, you know, do the one thing. You have the capacity to differentiate it. And I don't know if the differentiation, you know, what it could be, whether there's, you know, cultural differentiations that kind of favor certain aspects of, you know, certain iterations versus others, or if they're, you know, they could be, you know, context specific ones, which are maybe environmental things. You know, I don't know what products we're talking about, but that could be the positive aspects of that, that they could actually, you're not giving everybody a standard or a generic product. You are giving them a system that they can actually find within that opportunities to make something specific to their, you know, particular situation, right? So that was what we were kind of trying to put across in that particular aspect of the book.
So this is really interesting. I don't know if I'm on the right track, but I understand this as an individualistic response to globalization, right? Like there is a moment in the book that you mentioned that this type of movement highlights the opportunity to capture larger market shares, right? By focusing on selling a wider range of products, right? It's good, but at the same time, it's sad, right? Like, it's like a response of like fast fashion and all these movements that are really good at like generating products, manufacturing for the masses. But now we're seeing that everything we're able to parameterize more things that before were just like in the, let's say, mass production industry, right? So people understand at least what's on my mind. I see custom embroidery with your initials on like clothing stores or like your towels or things like that. But at the same time, maybe in the future, like right now we see like at least in Spain, songs that get marketed in Spain in Spanish, but then they're translated and elsewhere they're in English, right? So you can imagine this sort of customization to capitalize on basically what is like making people feel more special because they have a product that everyone else has, but it's customized, right? Yep. And this is like efficiency for adaptation, right? Like what you also mentioned on the book. And you also mentioned on the book a maid that's customizable items digitally needed on demand. It's similar to what I mentioned, but it's slightly different. The Nike by You, like many people know that you can order your custom Nike shoes, mm-hmm. make you feel a bit more special. I don't know if anyone will notice, but you know, because they have so many different models still. And also Objectile by Bernard Cash. So yeah, where do you think this is leading us, or what opportunities we have for design in this realm?
Yeah, so I mean, definitely there is the capacity for it to be abused. It's, you know, that capacity for customizing everything and individualizing everything, it's also a marketing opportunity. But, you know, if we also take it from, okay, so we bundle it together with this idea of the fourth industrial revolution, whatever. If it's the third or the fourth, whichever you sit on that, right, somehow. I think, you know, you could also think of it from another point of view, where if we think about industrial production in the past, there was the tendency to kind of do very large batches, and then you kind of create this huge inventory, and then it becomes, you know, something that either sits there and or whatever, you know, if you like. But in some senses, it could also be that, you know, you kind of minimize a little bit that problem of having to do the large batch, if you can actually kind of recalibrate these products so that they could be part of this ecosystem of localized manufacturers rather than, you know, centralized in a particular factory, and having this big supply chain, this kind of intricate supply chain that then has to ship it around the world, right? That's one model that perhaps, you know, if you bundle that together, it could differentiate. If we also want to be positive, you know, look at the positive capacities of that approach, is, you know, like we said before, there's the capacity to, rather than do one product, there's the capacity for it to be, you know, augmented so that it actually is specific to particular contexts, right? So, you know, again, it could be specific to cultural situations. It could be specific to climatic ones. It could be specific, depending on what the product is. You know, if we go beyond the shoes and all of these models are given as examples that are happening, but you could actually turn those into, you know, quite positive variations on that theme, because, like I said, the modernists or the industrial product, which is custom, you know, which is done for one particular optimized solution, isn't necessarily the one that's, you know, specific to every particular context. But that's what we have to deal with when we're dealing with industrial production somehow, that we all have to kind of adjust ourselves to this thing, right? So that's one possible positive, I guess, lens you can bring to it. Yeah.
In that sense, I mean, again, if we bring it back to the research that we've been doing, the issue of context was very important, whether it is a specific environment, you know, certain environmental context with its specificities, or certain site conditions or in terms of ground conditions, how, if we look at the precedents that we were looking into, let's tap onto Fuller again one more time. You know, you got the geodesic sphere and that is it, but there is not some things that we were looking into was the acknowledgement of what happens when you have certain terrain conditions in which you have to situate the sphere, when you have certain orientation, certain conditions in which establishing a clear orientation also is important. You know, when we look into this kind of environmental conditions. And then if we look at even smaller scales, in a society in which we are understanding more and more the wide range of neurodiverse individuals that we have, we need to acknowledge that and find ways by which you can deliver not the one size fits all, but this idea that you can cater to very different needs. And again, as David said, this can be abused, obviously. We acknowledge that. But we tend to go into it with a positive mind of like trying to do it for the well of everyone, not trying to get into it just with the business case of abusing the...
as parents of young children, this will be something that everybody, when you get young children, you start to see, you know, in some places they talk about not this kind of Fordist model of education, but they talk about individualized learning plans and all of these sorts of things, depending on the specific needs of young children. Lady was talking about neurodiversity. So, you know, in some sense, this is this kind of shift towards customizing or individualizing has, you know, some positive outcomes, because in many cases the Fordist model of education, Fordist model of production, all of these things were also destructive in many senses, or they actually, you know, excluded a lot of people.
A lot of geniuses were excluded from that Fordist model of education, but that's a different conversation.
Yeah, I think on the last episode with Frank Harmon, I discussed this topic in a slightly different sense. I think talking a bit about regionalism, right? Like making grounding buildings to their place and giving people a sense of place wherever they are, not just trying to repeat the same model as if it was out of a factory, wherever it is. So I think it, you know, that personalization has a lot of potential, and I think that is enabled by letting out open models that can be adapted digitally before they go into construction. Like if there is a proprietary system that only lets you, for example, imagine like the PDF that can be edited, right? You can only print it that way. So if you can change it slightly, change the font or like the colors, or just manipulate it a bit before you print it, you're going to get a different outcome depending on your needs. So yeah, I do think there are, you know, there's the two faces that every positive thing will be exploited. And I don't think it's so bad that people can customize things as well, right? They allows us to express ourselves in different ways as well. Okay, so I was actually contacted by Aktar, the publisher of the book, for this engagement, right? To be able to talk to you and have this opportunity, even though I have met you later at the Harvard ESD in the past. So I'm interested on knowing why you wrote the book, right? So that would be the first question, how your experience was with the publisher. And the third one is, how do you go from parallel publications, something that maybe at first was just publications that were disconnected from each other, into getting into a cohesive narrative and putting a series of writings that made sense together in a book format?
The course went over 6 years, so there was a lot of very interesting work and there was, you know, great outcomes. I think the book was an opportunity, I think, to reflect on, in one sense, the course is very particular to what Leda had done for 6 years there, but it also has a resonance or reverberation with the kind of process that I guess we apply in a lot of scales. It was a way to basically reflect on, you know, that model of, I guess, on one hand, teaching, but also kind of try to kind of extend it out so that it actually makes a larger, it connects to a larger kind of, you know, series of concerns. It builds its own microcosmology beyond just the bracketed course itself. The course drew from history. But what does it mean? Why would you actually engage, though, in that particular part of history? And why would you use the associative model? Like, you know, why don't we dig down deep into it and then consider the, you know, those repercussions at a kind of at a wider level? So it was an opportunity to reflect on that in the course. It was seen through the lens of new capacities in design tools and fabrication. But what if we connected it to a larger discussion about patents versus open source and industrial production versus the new models of production, you know, the onshoring ecosystems of, you know, local manufacturers that are being discussed recently. So it helped to kind of bridge and make connections to a larger considerations. And it also helped the outcomes of the course be contextualized, you know, within, you know, what you do as academic researchers and also as creative practitioners. We wanted to make that bridge between the two. And these were two parallel considerations that, you know, through the book we were able to somehow find a coherent, I guess, hopefully it's based on what the reader thinks, but it's a coherent, at least in our case, a coherent narrative about making that bridge between these different things. And, you know, the thing that was the backbone for all of that was Leda's course, right?
No, something that I mentioned earlier on. I mean, it was, in a way, I feel that this research, or at least this research onto, or rather this way of approaching design is something that we've been really doing for the past 20 so years, in a way. You know, probably the first time we got this interest was through a series of encounters during our time at DAA. And then that was kind of explored through different avenues, different courses that were dealing with different scales and scopes. So this is a very specific one in which we had the privilege to focus on it for a good 6 years, you know, the tectonic scale, and it was very, very interesting. So prior to the delivery of the course, obviously there was a research phase to prepare the material that I was going to be teaching. But that material didn't come just from me. In a way, it was coming from big baggage already in my adventure with David Ma. So I feel that he was very present there, even though I was delivering the course. And so I will say that answering to your question about why did you publish or what made you publish, during those years, we got approached, or I got approached several times to, oh, you should publish this, you know. And certainly we wrote a few essays and whatnot, but it was mentioned, the idea of publishing the work several times. But I just felt that you know, the work that the students had produced had been showcased in various places, you know, and exhibitions and essays, papers. And I think we both felt there was still more fertile ground to be explored. And that's what triggered the subsequent extra 4 years of research once we moved here to Melbourne and used the idea of, okay, now let's start seriously thinking about publishing the work. And then the questions David mentioned came about, you know, and made us reflect deeper into why the associative model, why these precedents, and a lot of the other questions that you brought today, you know. And at the same time, it also gave us the opportunity with the lessons learned through the previous research to the course, through the course, to explore even deeper the associative model, using in this case specifically Hauer as a base to depart from. In a way, I will say all the background about why we ended up publishing. And then when looking at actual publishers, we had previously worked with ACTA, and I have to say that it was really nice, I will say, collaboration, because that's another side of things when you actually put together the object, the book, and working with Ramon and his team is always been a great experience. So we just got in touch with them, and that's it. That's how the book was actually published.
We were also, you know, encountering questions about what design research is within an academic context, right? So the book is also trying to make a contribution to that larger discussion of, you know, this vexed question of design research within an academic setting somehow, and one that actually has direct relevance for creative practice or professional practice, if you like. So that's, you know, that's also a contribution that we were trying to make through the book as well.
So how was the process of going from parallel essays, right? Like that you have written, disconnect from each other, maybe with related topics, into a series of writings, right? One after the other. Did you have to maybe edit them a bit, or maybe you had to write transitions or remake some of them or write new ones? This is, I'm thinking from the point of view of like, for myself, I have a lot of writing out there, but many disconnected pieces, or maybe other people have similar publications that they've done, but they're thinking, oh, in the future, how would I go about getting this into a book?
One of the things is, yes, you do start off in parallel, and it sometimes it can feel a bit disjointed initially. I don't know if you've ever seen that piece, reading two books. There's a person holding two books and two eyes looking that way. It can feel a little bit like that when you're trying to pursue different issues in parallel. I think, yes, you were asking from a writer's point of view, how to manage that. I think it starts off quite explosive in the sense that actually you're kind of looking at these different issues individually. But once you kind of identify a particular, let's say, larger project around which it coalesces, it becomes easier to kind of bind it together. And yes, there might be a little bit of bridging across the text, but actually, if you also read the texts in the book, they can also be read as individual essays in and of themselves too. I think they do touch the different aspects that the book is trying to engage, but in the aggregate, they tell a larger arc, if you like. So that's kind of how they operate. Yeah.
One thing that I should clarify, in case I didn't, maybe it was my own misunderstanding. But we had written pieces that were touching on this subject or some of these subjects, that they were contributions to other books. But actually the essays in the book, we pretty much started them by scratch once we decided that we were serious about getting this book out, you know. So of course they were informed by pieces that we had written before, but unfortunately for us, we couldn't get a collection of previous essays and somehow they fitted the book, and we could kind of use them by just editing them. We can, truth be told, is we wrote them from scratch, even though they are informed from from also other pieces of writing that we had done before.
No, that's good to know. I mean, it's sometimes if you want to do the opposite, like it's a bit like a clash, right? But you need to acknowledge that everything's like a disconnect from maybe just thematically related. But yeah, it makes sense. I mean, probably inspired by, but starting from from scratch. So we're coming to the end of the interview. I have here a question that, as I understand, you're looking at the process that somebody else followed to design something and trying to guess it in some way. I want to know if you have any thoughts on who cares about understanding the creative process and how things are made.
Yeah, so I think we're also, in that sense, you have to pardon the fact that we are possibly approaching it from an academic point of view, where, you know, we are quite interested, you know, this idea of design research being discussed in the academy, if you like. We found that the typical discussion around design history typically, you know, it's around either contextualizing it within a particular period. You can, you know, talk about it in relationship to styles and all of those sorts of things. Or it can be kind of trying to explain through the kind of biography of the author, right? That's quite often the kind of dominant models of historical like research, and trying to give sense or give meaning to a lot of the kind of design history, artifacts and design history. So we were quite interested in doing a form model of design history where you are somehow trying to come close to or understand the actual creative process or the actual descriptive process that help us understand. And they could have also been part of the repertoire of the authors themselves, because they, we think it's kind of this history of designing rather than design artifacts. It's the kind of process is something that we wanted to open as a possible approach of engaging with history, particularly if we were quite interested in bridging between historical research, which might be kind of associated with the academy, and having a very direct bridge to creative practice as it is a practiced thing, right? Somehow, so we wanted to make that bridge, and that's why we look very specifically at trying to follow this model, so that it's not just the object, but it's also how you got there, which was important. It's not a secret. If you read through the texts, you can see that there's a very clear influence of people like Robin Evans, were very much embedded in the way that we also came to understand, the creative practice as well. And that's also an answer to another question, also about the collection of essays. If you read that book, Translations from, Drawing to Building, it is literally a collection of his essays, which are not theoretically bound by an overarching story. But if you read them in the aggregate, they tell a very, very strong, they kind of deliver a very strong, narrow arc, or they kind of deliver a very particular sensibility about the creative process, all of those sorts of things. So, that was something that was inspiring to us on a number of different levels, I guess.
It was at least my impression that there are a series of peers, contemporaries that I think care as much as we do about these questions. So I feel that hopefully the book is interesting and contributes to that those discourses going on. At the same time, I will say it's a design approach and process that interest us, and I think some of our peers. But ultimately, it's true. Who cares? As long as the outcome is proposing something that is interesting for the reasons that we mentioned before, for the context, for the targeting very specific needs, generating sight, or planes rather, and all these things, probably ultimately the end user probably doesn't care how we got there. I think for the designers, the architects that we are embarked on this boat, and as I say, contemporary peers, I think it's relevant, and for other people that might be interested, but ultimately I think it's an interesting way to arrive to something that is interesting as an outcome as well, for on the other end, basically, for the user.
I was just going to say that it's a contribution to designers as well, I guess. I mean, I think one thing that I find problematic in a lot of history is that it's quite detached. It's always trying to contextualize what is done within larger social things, or like a kind of nominally tied to a biography, the different influences from the life. But, it'd be nice to have a history or a base, body of knowledge, which is really looking at how how did you actually, what are the forms of design that you use to arrive at certain things somehow? And, if we have that body of knowledge that, I think that one can only contribute to our knowledge of design, design research generally, right? Somehow,
Yeah, I often do this question myself. I've even written mini essays about the topic, and yeah. I often find that it's the process of reverse engineering, like it's an analog to the sort of creative process of the artist, the designer. It's somebody who's trying to understand, maybe like a historian or like a psychologist trying to understand what went on, but also some peer that wants to learn how you got to that place so they can also do it, maybe replicate it, but then later adapt it and make it their own. I often find that, who cares about how other people write? Probably writers, right? Or journalists, or like people who are going to sit and write. For people who just read books, they don't care that much unless they're really curious. So I don't know. I think it's a good way of thinking that it's, people like us usually care about the processes that we do, right? Because they have to go through the same struggles.
One caveat is that, we just also want to kind of clarify that we wouldn't, the ambition is never about the replication. In our case, it's basically a capacity for you to kind of learn from that knowledge and extend and do, your own or everyone's, own instantiations, but building on that knowledge somehow, right? So the idea is really never, in our case, it was never about replicating directly the existing artifacts. Sorry, qualification that we wanted to make.
Disclaimer.
Disclaimer, yeah.
Disclaimer. Following from what you just said, Nono, and maybe this is a slightly different angle. I think, again, as architects, I mean, representation, we learn through drawing, through that's the way in which we abstract as well things. And I feel that very often and more these days when you ask students to do research on certain precedents, it's all about a collection of images from the internet and that's it, you know, but there is not much learning from it unless you actually invest the time in extracting certain lessons. And drawing continues to be a medium by which you can do that, basically. So in a way, I know this is taking it all the way to the reverse engineering, et cetera, but I feel that it's not that far off also from researching by actually drawing and in that you choose which are the aspects that you actually draw. And that's why when we were talking about the reverse engineering, I was saying it's our interpretation of those found objects. So obviously we are looking at it with a specific lens and interest that maybe we are leaving out some of the author's desires, especially in the case, again, of Power, that he was an artist.
There is one last topic related, slightly related to what you said about images online. Before I do that question or we start that topic, I want to remember everyone that I'll post links on the show notes or where you can get the book, or you can read more about the book, and also where you can find Larry and David online, so their Instagram account. And the last thing, I think, because we're a bit tight on time, how would you compare or what are your thoughts of machine learning, AI, or systems like DALL-E that can create new combinations from pre-existing images in relation to the work that you've done and maybe studying historical styles and then generating new things?
So I noticed in your series of podcasts, you've been quite engaged in exploring DALL-E. So, you know, I think I'll just come back to what Lady and I were discussing about, in many ways, for us, at least the code that enabled the whole practice that was, you know, the backbone of the book was really the kind of geometric associations, the capacity to kind of coordinate or associate all of these geometries into these composites. And within that, being able to evaluate it and figure out which set of associations were the ones that would be most fruitful for generating, you know, new iterations. So I think in some senses, you know, we think about it in relationship to machine learning. I mean, I would assume that there's probably a lot of research that's going on at the moment in looking at that capacity to actually make it something that would actually be, you know, made possible through AI as a kind of vehicle to do a lot of the work for us. But I think in many ways, it would be important for us, I think, as architects, because if we have that mastery over this kind of geometric code, it might be, you know, that would be our, you know, we that would be the mechanism that allows us to be part of that conversation, I think, somehow, right? I mean, I know there's a lot of possibilities, a lot of people who are maybe perhaps even better at geometry than us in some senses. But I think that, you know, even that story that we were talking about, the design one, reverse engineering design one, they were ones that were more closely adhering to the original model. And then the ones which were more schematic and they were more fruitful as generative objects, right? Generative models. I think having that capacity to do that and evaluate it and having that kind of agility to kind of develop those associations, customize them ourselves is going to be important in the process. So, you know, I feel that somehow in the case of DALL-E, you know, I think we've all probably dabbled in a few different platforms. So there's Stable Diffusion, DALL-E, Midjourney, all of those things. But each one of them have their own kind of like proclivities, no? Each one has different tendencies. And it's this black box that's inside the, you know, your inputs and in the black box and then outside something comes out as a consequence and they have differences, right? I think somehow, you know, for us, the black box is that kind of geometric code kind of association. So I think that is hopefully still benefits greatly from our expertise, disciplinary expertise, I think somehow.
Yeah, no, I think from what you just mentioned, that black box is slightly the difference that we can see here with the work that you have done and shown in the book, right? Because what you're doing the black box part comes from maybe making complex models or things that other people cannot understand, but it's open and you can read through the rules that generated some design. Everything's encoded, everything is like broken down in an associative model, right? In the case of DALL-E, for instance, or Midjourney, you know the process that is just ingesting a lot of semantics and images in, and it's outputting something out, but we still don't have a lot of progress there in terms of explainability, right? Why did it come up with a specific artifact or solution? You're always only seeing like input and output, but you're missing exactly how you're tweaking the thing in the middle. So I think there is a lot of work, and we're going to learn a lot more on how to use these models or benefit from them when we can actually make sense on why the model is outputting what it's outputting, and not just, you know, for me, the experience with DALL-E is like you have an idea in your mind of what you want to get to, and you have to kind of bang the keyboard, like changing things, changing like slightly the words, the phrasing, to see how the outcome changes. But it's not super clear why that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, hands and faces are interesting. Usually. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's a bit weird. Like sometimes like hands or arms or like legs look alike and they mix. And then depending on how you look at the image, it changes your perception. Mm. But yeah, I think, you know, it's going to be an interesting field to talk about originality as well. And, you know, like who made something, like they claim that something was made with DALL-E, but there's like a lot of stuff inside that probably doesn't belong to them. It's not like Creative Commons or, yeah, I don't know. It's going to probably require new regulation in terms of law and how things are measured.
Yeah. Certainly one of the things that I find interesting is also that, you know, it's obviously an explosion of new AI images now as a consequence of that on these different social media platforms. But you can, you know, out of the multitudes of images and authors, if you like, or let's say they call them prompt engineers.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can find ones that have a very particular, or they've stumbled on a particular style and they've developed a kind of a kind of flavor or sensibility somehow that emerges. It's odd. I don't know. I mean, I think it's something that, I think we need a little bit of time to reflect on it to kind of see the, kind of get the full reading of it for sure. But yeah, but I mean, you know, there is reverberations between that and in the fact that, you know, we are making an argument for building on the past in some sense. We are making an argument for this digital design, which isn't about, you know, pretending that it's a clear break from modernity and all of these sorts of things. We are saying that they were building on the knowledge of precedents. So there is kind of a resonance there.
Cool. I think we can probably leave it here. So thanks a lot for your time today, Larry and David. For everyone that is here today with us, I might have mentioned that before, but they together form what's called the Ascensio Ma Design Practice. They have physical buildings out in the world and that they have built, and they conduct also practice and research on master planning and like what we've been talking today. So thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you very much. It's been actually a pleasure, and I have to say that when you said your podcast can be over an hour and a half, it was hard to believe, but time flew. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. See you.
See you.
Yeah, thanks for giving me an excuse to read something related to design during my vacation. It's been good. The book is awesome. Before you go, I'd like to remind you that you can find detailed episode notes at gettingsimple.com, and then you can submit questions about this or any previous episodes at gettingsimple.com/ask. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.